From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For radio producer Alex Bloomberg, leaving the relative comfort of public radio for the private sector was risky and kind of scary. So he could be forgiven moments of self-doubt.
I'm just one guy with this stupid little plan, and there's like a gazillion people out there with better plans that are going to make more money.
Alex is starting a podcast network. So naturally, he started a podcast about starting the podcast network. It's called Startup. Anyway, it's giving us a chance to talk to him about it, what he's learning about the future of radio, what it was like to quit his day job, and whether he wants this bad enough. Alex Bloomberg today, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We public radio folks are like the rest of the radio universe in wringing our hands about our future in this information age. So it's been fascinating to listen to producer Alex Bloomberg's new podcast, where he goes out into the real world, the private sector, to make a pitch for well-produced narrative audio storytelling. You may have heard by now that Alex has left public radio, left NPR's Planet Money, left his role on This American Life, and is out there raising money for a podcast network. He's even started a podcast about it called Startup, which he describes as a series about what happens when someone who knows nothing about business starts one. Alex is joining us today to talk about all of this, not just what it's like to start a business outside the comforts of public broadcasting, but what he's learning about audiences and what kind of effect something like this has on your family and your self-confidence. Alex is joining us today from NPR Studios in New York City. And Alex, welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to start by asking, when did you first start thinking about this, that maybe it was time that you tried to kind of venture out? Like, what was the first thing that got you thinking about it?
It's hard to pinpoint the exact moment, but it was something that had always been on my mind. It was sometime after starting Planet Money. And when we started Planet Money, it was, you know, it was directly after the financial crisis, and so we didn't know if sort of as the financial crisis, you know, sort of the effects of it slowly wound down, if the popularity would continue.
Yeah.
And it did. And so you know, it continued, and the audience to the podcast continued to grow. And that got me thinking, like, oh, there's an actual demand for this kind of narrative programmed on-demand listening. You know, borrowing tricks from This American Life, but you know, sort of applied to other different subject areas. There's a demand for this kind of stuff, and it's working here. And I would love to sort of see what other programs we could start that sort of operate on the same principles.
So, how much of this was? I mean, clearly, you were thinking about the fact that, hey, I could make some money off of this. I could be financially successful. So, how much of it was that, and how much of it was just the idea of kind of going off onto an enterprise and seeing if you could, because, you know, we often talk about it in public radio. Could I make it in the real world?
I mean, the answer is emphatically yes. A lot of the skills that we have developed in public radio are very transferable in the real world. Making money is wonderful, and, like, you know, you get to a point in your life and you've got a family and you're like, oh, I wish I had more money. Yeah. I think that's not a surprising thing. But to me, and I very much want this to be financially successful for myself, but also what I'm realizing is sort of like, if you are very profitable, what most businesses do is they reinvest those profits into new programming.
Yeah.
And so if what you want to do is sort of create a whole slate of new programs, you need to be successful financially in order to generate the money to do that. So unless we're very successful financially, you know, we're not going to be able to create new programs every year, which we want to do. So that's a big part of it. And then, you know, there's something nice about sort of creating something and having equity in the thing that you've created. That was something that I began to crave a little bit.
Yeah. This may seem a little awkward since we're doing in the middle of a pledge drive, I wonder if one of the things you have said is that this project felt refreshingly straightforward. You know, like this is here's something we made, as you say in your podcast. You guys want it, you buy it. That's great. I mean, there's something you liked that. Not that there was anything wrong with a fund drive, I guess, but you did like the fact that it was a little bit more straightforward.
Well, the fund drive, I mean, I'm glad that you brought it up because I have a lot of thoughts on the fund drive. And so public radio is this mysterious thing because, as I've gone out into the real world and sort of talked to business people about the way they think of these things, there's, you know, viewed one way, public radio is incredibly successful. Like the participation rates, you know, essentially public radio is doing what they call a freemium model. You give your stuff away for free and then you get some percentage of your listeners to pay for it by, you know. And normally the way they do it outside of the public radio world is they try to entice their listeners by giving them extra stuff. And in public radio, what we do is we sort of annoy you and badger you and provide you the worst programming of the year at the very moment we're asking you for money.
Right.
and yet it works, and it works really well. Like, and that is a testament to the immense connection I think that public radio has made with its listeners. I have this metaphor. Did you ever see Monsters, Inc.?
Yeah.
So you remember the sort of the turning point in Monsters, Inc. is the monsters, they have the city, it's run on the screams of children. And so the monsters go out and they go into the bedrooms of the children, they get them to scream, that powers the monster city. And there's a pivotal moment 2/3 of the way through the movie where a monster inadvertently makes a child laugh. And then, you know, sort of the power sensors go off the roof and all of a sudden they realize, oh, wait, we can generate way more power through laughter than through screams. Mm. I think you see where I'm going with this, right? I think public radio is still generating power off of screams, and it works. But I feel like one of the things that I really want to test is whether there's if you sort of delight people, and really try to make it fun and exciting, if they wouldn't be more willing to hand over money than less. So that's a big thing that I want to try to test.
Yeah, I guess. Was part of the decision to do this a concern about terrestrial radio? I mean, is that something that, I mean, you're thinking about all of these different dimensions. But were you worried about that? Are you worried about that?
No, I'm not worried about it because I feel like because I feel like people want what they want and sort of how it gets delivered is people don't really care about that much, you know? And so to me, if you're making stuff that people want to listen, That's the main thing. And to me, it was more like, here's this opportunity to sort of now you can get to anybody right now through the internet. You don't need the airwaves necessarily. And so to me, it was sort of like, oh, now we have, you know, we can, you know, make as much stuff as we want as long as we can support it financially. Yeah. And so that was it was really much more of a positive draw. Like, oh, we'll be able to do so much more.
I wonder if you think the models are already in place. You know, there's Radiolab, there's This American Life. Or do you think they're still kind of working out the formats? I mean, you've got these different categories in podcasting, a lot of sort of, you know, radio, public radio-like journalism stories, stuff like, frankly, what you're doing with Startup, you know, lots of production elements and careful editing and writing and, in some cases, you know, sound design. But then there's that other model that was developed. It seems like outside of public radio, you know, the more conversational pods, the WTF, the Joe Rogan stuff, the Adam Savage stuff. So what do you think about the models that seem to be working in the podcasting universe? Are you getting a sense of that?
Right now, the revenue model that works, I think a lot of what's driving the offerings in podcasting right now are the revenue models that work. And right now, it is very, very cost effective to produce a talk show format. That's sort of like there's you don't have to send people out. You don't have to sort of like kill stories. You don't have to, you know, there's not as much production that goes into it. And so that's a sustainable model right now. What we're trying to test is if you can do bigger budgets, can you bring in the revenues to support those bigger budgets? Because, you know, I know, you know, sort of like the budget of This American Life is, you know, in the millions of dollars. The budget of a Planet Money is up there as well. So to create, you know, there's probably efficiencies you could gain there, but like it's expensive programming to create. And the question is sort of like, if we create that expensive programming, will it pay off with bigger audiences that you can then sort of generate bigger revenues from? That's the sort of the central question. And right now, that it seems to be like the top of the iTunes charts are those more highly produced ones out there. So so that suggests that maybe there's this business model here. That's what we're trying to test.
So you're still figuring it out. I mean, I guess that's the point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is this is a risky startup. I believe we have seen enough people making it. So certain there've been part of what has been motivating me has been sort of the successes we've had with at This American Life and at Planet Money. Those are successes. People like it. They're financially, self-sufficient, it's exciting to see. So that's one thing. But then there's the independence, like Roman Mars, who does a podcast called 99% Invisible, a great podcast, weekly podcast about design, highly produced, sort of like he takes a lot of craft, and he's fully, making it on his own now. And he was a big inspiration, sort of like seeing him sort of make it felt like, okay, this is something that can be done.
I wonder if, public radio should worry about whether podcasting needs it anymore. I mean, it seems like it was the platform that got a lot of these programs started. 99% Invisible, obviously, started as I think it was like a 4-minute segment on a public radio station. But now they've got, the 20 minutes and more. And he said recently in an article I read that distribution on public radio means less and less over time. So it was the platform, the jumping off point. But I wonder if should public radio people be kind of worrying about that?
That's a loaded question, Doug. I think there's two answers. One is that I think what people will always pay for is good content. And so as long as public radio is in the business of creating good content that people seek out and want, they're going to be fine. It's going to be fine no matter how it's delivered. I think there's a tendency for people when you're creating content on top of a distribution system that you control, there's a tendency to get lazy and to attribute your success to the fact that you just controlled a pipe. Yeah. And I think that's the danger for any legacy media that is sort of like seeing the ground shift under its feet. And I think that's people recover, companies recover, they figure it out. But I feel like that's the moment that public radio is in right now. And they've been insulated from it for a long time because so much listening happens in cars and cars were late to adopt the sort of streaming, sort of digital delivery. But that's all changing now. And, you can get a car now with a data plan and there's going to be on podcasting buttons on the dashboard in a lot of cars. And, so that's the big moment. And yeah, I think it's a worrying moment, but I feel like as long as, the response is we're going to double down on creating the best content available and deliver it in whatever way people want to listen to it, I think it's going to be fine.
If we get it right, it can make us better.
Yeah.
I guess is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But people always freak out about change.
People do.
Especially people during a fun drive.
It's exactly. People like me and my wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Which we'll get to, by the way, because I loved that. I loved the relationship in the podcast. Let me ask you this, though, before we get to that. How were you thinking about, the commercial part of the presentation of a podcast, or the presentation of a story, incorporating, sponsors into all of this, how you figured that might affect your journalism and your sense of ethics in creating a firewall between that part and the journalism part. I mean, you must have worried about that a bit anyway.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I think it's something that it's something that you can't sort of like, I think it's something that you have to perpetually worry about.
Yeah.
Like, I think the only way to make it work is to always be aware of, like, what is the line? Are we crossing the line? So far, I feel like, our experience has been pretty phenomenal, which is that, it's been, we've been able to do something that feels very creative, that the audience seems totally fine with, and that is as transparent as anything you'll hear anywhere, So as to me, the danger of sort of like getting creative, as people say, getting creative with your ads, the danger of that is that by getting creative, they mean disguising.
Right.
And sort of like making it seem like content when in fact it's an advertisement. And to me, that is the one That is the one inviolate sort of thing that we need to always do is if it's a paid, if I'm saying something that somebody's paying me to say, that always has to be utterly clear. And as long as that's utterly clear, I think it creates a place where you can sort of do things that sound different, mm-hmm. but if anything, they're even more transparent than not. It's just you just have to make it very, very clear. This is the paid part. Now, you know, so discount this as you will,
yeah.
you know, and then once the paid part's over, we're back to the regular programming. So that's, you know, it's easy for us to do now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One piece I read, this man named Adam Sachs, he's with Midroll Media. It's a big podcast network.
Yeah.
WTF, Nerdist, Comedy Bang Bang, all those. And he said this, he said, passive endorsement is really powerful, which I guess on one hand could sound kind of, you know, creepy and manipulative. But I guess you have to kind of get over that pretty quickly. I mean, if you're going to go in this direction in the first place, this is a commercial enterprise. You've got to decide where your boundaries are, I guess, and then go forward, I suppose.
I mean, this is the reason that anybody's advertising anywhere. This is the reason that people underwrite public radio,
right.
is because of the it gives them a passive endorsement. They're buying, you know, they call it the halo effect.
Yeah.
And so absolutely that's a valid concern. One of the things that I really want to do though is to figure out mechanisms as quickly as possible so that we can get listener revenue,
right.
that we can get listener support, that we can get, you know, subscription models, or we can have these sort of regular sort of like bi-yearly events where people buy products that are somehow associated with the podcast, where we can sort of generate a healthy revenue stream from our listeners, because that just gives you a nice ballast. Then you're not too dependent on an advertiser. I think any media company that's trying to make it all ad dependent is, you know, living in the past. I don't think that really happens anymore. So we're really, that's why we really want to make sure that we're like developing both revenue streams. It's important from a, you know, just sort of from a business perspective, but also from, I think, a content perspective.
How do you figure programming itself is going to, I mean, we talked a little bit about this, but how itself, programming itself is going to change? Because you've talked about that when you have this direct relationship with your listening audience, you can do different things or cool things or interesting things. And I guess at this point, you're not sure exactly what that means. I guess you get you get feedback from them, and that you incorporate into the way you're producing the things that you're producing. And in that sense, it evolves, I guess, over time.
I think you develop a relationship basically with your listeners, and you know this. It's like anybody in radio knows this, that it's a very intimate medium.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the reasons, going back to the thing we said about public radio before, you know, public radio is getting 10% participation. That's participation rates that everybody else in every other digital media sector would be killing for.
Yeah.
You know, 10% of the audience kicks in. And I think it's because it's a very intimate medium. It's a conversation. You're sitting in a conversation. I have this about the people I listen to. I feel like they're my friend. And people feel that way about me. And we feel about each other. So I think part of it is like there's that nice relationship, and I do get feedback from the listeners, and it's very, very helpful. And part of it is like trying to figure out, like, is there a way to sort of harness that and build a business on it that feels good for everybody? Build a business that feels like the people who are inclined and willing to kick in money have the option to do so, and it's easy for them and it's exciting for them. And the people who can't or don't want to, you know, that's okay. We'll get by without them.
I want to talk about the podcast startup. So it's a podcast about someone starting a business who doesn't really know how to start a business.
Yes.
And I wanted there's a terrific section, and I wanted to play a couple of parts here. One was you make this initial pitch, and I think anyone who heard, by the way, This American Life, this part was on This American Life a couple of weeks ago. This is from episode one of Startup. Alex's new
All
podcast.
Right. And you I'm go, pre-wincing right now.
Well, this is you making the... we're going to hear Chris Sacca, actually, because I think that you blow the pitch, basically, to him. Let's set this
badly.
Up first. Tell us who Chris Sacca is.
So Chris Sacca was... When I first went out to sort of like... When I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I just need to find some people to give me money. I had no idea what I was talking about, who those people might be. You know, and Chris Sacca was somebody that I'd interviewed for a... story a long time ago, and all I knew about him was that he was a Silicon Valley investor, and I knew he was pretty rich, and I knew that he liked This American Life. So I was like, okay, good. I'm going to go out there and talk to him, and he has lots of money. He'll give me some. And that's pretty much as sophisticated. People ask me, were you really that naive? I really was. I didn't really know how it worked exactly. So I went out and I had a pitch deck, and I'd put together some numbers and stuff like that. But I made my pitch to him, and I just blew it. I was really nervous. I was like all over the place. I just didn't have it together.
Yeah. So he... In this section from the story, he makes the pitch for you. Here it is.
Yeah, he finally got so tired of me that he was like, okay, I'm going to give your pitch back to you the way you should be doing it.
Hey, look, can I get 2 minutes from you? So here's the thing. You probably know me, producer of This American Life, a successful radio show, top of the podcast, and iTunes, etc. So here's the thing. I realize there's a hunger for this kind of content out there. There's none of this shit. It's just a bunch of... jerk off podcast. Nothing's out there. Advertisers are dying for it. Users are dying for it. And if you look at the macro environment, we're seeing more and more podcast integrations into cars. People want this content. It's a whole new button in the latest version of iOS. So here's the thing. Nobody else can make this. I know how to make it better than anybody else in the world. And so I've already identified a few key areas where I know there's hunger for the podcast. You got the subject matter. We're going to launch this. I know there's advertisers who want to get involved with it. But here's the unfair advantage I have. Because of what I've done in my past careers with This American Life, with Planet Money, people are actually willing to just straight up pay for this stuff. And I'm not just talking about traditional subscriptions. I'm talking, we did this t-shirt experiment at Planet Money where we got $600,000 to come in, where people actually gave us money to buy a t-shirt with our logo on it as part of the content. It was integrated directly. And I know we can replicate that across these other platforms. So here's what we're doing. We're putting together $1.5 million that's going to buy us 3-4 guys who are going to launch these 3 podcasts in the next 12 months. We think very easily we could get to 300,000-400,000 net subscribers across the whole thing. With CPMs where they are in this market right now, I know on advertising alone we could get to break even, but as we do more of this integration, we get people buying some of this product, doing some of these integrated episodes. I know that we're going to have on our hands here something that will ultimately scale to be a network of 12, 15 podcasts. The audience is there. They want it. Nobody else can do it like we can. Are you in?
That was amazing.
That's your story, right?
Yeah.
I have to say, just sort of a little diversion here. Do you feel like a sense of freedom that you can actually include curse words in your podcast where you couldn't on radio?
Yes. Yes. It's been surprisingly, it's like real people talk.
Yeah.
And you know, not that we're gratuitous about it, but like every once in a while somebody says a curse word and you can just keep it in.
Yeah. Well, so at this point in the story then, you are like, wow, my pitch worked. Or
yeah.
At least his version of it, at least it could work,
right.
I guess. Like I didn't pitch it right, but at least I've got an idea there.
Yeah, and I thought, well, if he gave me my pitch back to me as good as he did, then he must be interested. But then he's turned around and he said, "But actually, I could give you the other side as well. I could give you the counter argument."
Yeah, which he does.
Mm-hmm.
I could come at it from the other side. Yeah. Media is very, very hard, as you know. This content's really hard to consume. It's longer form. You're counting on people spending that kind of dedicated time. I mean, you're fighting an overall trend of attention, and every other format is going to shorter and shorter content pieces. And so you're actually swimming upstream with that stuff. You have a lot of platform risk because you're depending upon Apple and Google to distribute your content. The kind of stuff you're doing with Planet Money is exciting, but it's all under the veil of being a nonprofit. People feel a moral obligation to contribute to those kinds of things. You come outside from under the public radio veil, and you have to worry about whether people are going to be a little bit jaded and feel like they don't necessarily need to donate to a for-profit company to make for-profit content for guys who are doing this for equity and hoping to get rich. You know, frankly, you think you might actually be uniquely qualified to do this, but we've started to see more and more news podcasts make their way up there. Some stuff from Khan Academy is moving up the ladder right now. So ultimately, you're not going to be the only guys in here, and it's going to be pretty competitive. Audio is kind of a niche market, and so I don't know. I don't know if this is a fit for us.
Pretty convincing the other way too, isn't it?
Totally. Which makes me wonder how business works. I mean, you can sell. Some of these guys can just sell anything, right? I mean, at least on some level.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, and it's sort of like, it's, I guess sort of part of what it is you just, is finding the people who want to be sold by the thing that you're trying to sell.
Right. You know? Well, what are you giving you? You mentioned this, and then you sort of, you decompress, you talk to your wife about all of this, and, you know, obviously to us about it. But Chris had basically given you these two very different pitches. And you say in the piece, at least at that moment, it kind of made you lose whatever conviction you had had. I mean, you really, did that make you wonder, could this thing actually work?
I believe it will work. It made me wonder, can I make it happen?
Yeah.
You know, it made me wonder like, oh, this is, I have to do a lot more work. I had a little bit of a naive belief about how easy it was going to be to get the money together to do this, you know, and because it's so clear to me that it's a good idea, and it's an idea that deserves to get tested out, and I am the person who should test it out. Mm-hmm. That felt very clear.
Right.
So it didn't make me lose faith in the idea. It made me lose faith in my ability to do what I needed to do to make the idea happen.
We're going to take a break here in a moment. When we get back, I want to sort of go with you on where this heads, which is in some way you're trying to keep control of your original vision, because as you talk to more and more people, they want you to do something that's bigger and bigger. And it seems like you're losing control, or you risk losing control. We'll talk about that when we get back from a break. Alex Bloomberg is with us, of course, former producer with This American Life. His new podcast about getting a startup company off the ground is called Startup. You can find it online at herestartup.com. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Alex Bloomberg is joining us. Alex, as you know, or probably know anyway, enjoyed a pretty respectable career in public radio, executive producer on This American Life, co-hosted NPR's Planet Money podcast. But as you may have heard, he's quit his day job, ditched public radio, and is trying to go it alone as a business entrepreneur. He's joining us to talk about it. We're talking about his podcast, the first one anyway, of this enterprise called Startup. He's joining us from NPR Studios in New York City. So sort of where we left off was that, I guess the thing that you really encountered at this point in the enterprise is, what the question is whether or not this idea was big enough. Because what they wanted wasn't just, a respectable podcast network. They wanted, I think, as you put it in the podcast, they wanted Twitter.
Right. Well, there's these terms that you learn. Like early on, like I was talking to somebody, and they were like, "Well, what are you trying to build? Are you trying to build a real business, or are you trying to build a lifestyle business?" And I was like, "What's a lifestyle business?" And they were like, "I don't know, $10-20 million, and kicks off a couple million dollars a year, but it's not like and I understand, and then versus a venture scale business, which is something that has the capacity to get huge and become $500 million, $1 billion, and obviously nobody knows where exactly the definition ends of what's a lifestyle business and what's a successful business and what's a venture scale business. I mean, everybody has their own line, but from their perspective, what they want is what a VC, a typical VC, is doing is they're placing lots of bets, and they're placing it at very early stages on people that are trying to imagine a thing that does not exist.
Right.
You know, they're essentially a bunch of delusional schizophrenics, right? Like people who believe that there's a thing out there that nobody else can see.
Yeah.
And so you're giving these people money. And so you know a lot of them are going to fail. And if there's a success, it needs to be a huge success to make it worth your while and to make you able to cover all your losses. And so that's what they're looking for. They're looking for a path, at least something that they can, that's a credible path to hugeness. And so that's a big task of the person pitching, is to be sort of convincing and also make the case that, like, listen, we're gonna return your money at 50, 100, 1,000 times what you put in. Either we're going to get so big, we're going to become Facebook, we're going to have an IPO, or we're going to get pretty big and somebody like Facebook is going to buy us because we're so valuable and we're kicking off so much revenue. So that's sort of your task as somebody who's pitching a VC. And I didn't realize that really when I first went out. And often if you have something that's sort of intriguing but isn't quite venture size, they can pitch back to you and sort of say, this would be, that's what you have is intriguing, and here's what would make it venture size, you know, sort of. And like, if you added a technology component, that's the way you get true scale.
Right.
And that's scary because then it's sort of like, oh, I see. This is, now I'm getting pitched. You know, I hadn't imagined that, you know. And it's like, oh, and then you get into this very, very, what I found to be a very, very classic conflict of the entrepreneur of sort of like, how much do I value my investor's opinion? How much do I alter my original vision and go along with a vision that I, you know, absolutely makes a lot of sense versus how much do I just stick to what I know?
Yeah.
And it's something that as we did an episode about this and the emails just came pouring in of like so many different people who've been in that exact position. It's a really tricky position.
Yeah, they want you to. Let me play a clip. Actually, this is from
This
is episode 3, and you've called your wife, so you've just been pitched basically back. In other words,
right. Yes.
Look, don't just do a Alex. Don't just do a podcast network. Make it essentially a technology company. And so you're calling your wife, Nazanin, and you're pretty upset about it. I mean, you're not quite sure what to make of it. Here's a clip from Alex Bloomberg's podcast Startup.
It just makes me feel like I don't know what I'm doing. Like they see a whole different world for me, you know, than I see for myself.
Articulate what that world is, or what it is.
Yeah. It's like a world where you're rolling out the programs, and you're building a technology platform along with that, and you're like, I don't know. It's like, yeah.
Why does that make you upset that they're saying that?
I don't know.
I mean, you don't need to be a technology company if you don't want to be. Like, you're talking to tech guys about giving you money, so.
Right.
But it makes sense that they would see it this way.
I know. But I think that they're right. I think if it didn't feel true, I don't think I would feel as depressed. You know what it is? I know what it is. This is the thing. I'm sitting there talking to this guy, and I'm describing something that feels like the biggest thing I've ever done, like a scale beyond my wildest imaginings, something that I can't even tell if I could pull off. And it's totally not big enough. Like, it seems small to him.
It seems like, Alex, this is kind of a theme in this process so far, at least in the episodes that I've been listening to, this idea of you trying to sort of stay grounded on some level, and try to keep the original vision that you had in mind, you know, alive as you go through this kind of scary process.
Well, I mean, I think you're giving me even more credit. I'm just trying to figure out, like, that would be one way of looking at it. The truth is, I don't know who's right. Like, you know, like, part of the problem that I'm trying to do is sort of like, every single big company you've ever heard of started as one thing and became another thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Twitter started as a podcasting company.
Yeah.
So was it the right decision for them to stay true to their vision, or was it the right decision for them to become Twitter? Probably to become Twitter, you know? That's one of the things that's so confusing about the whole thing is sort of like, you have this instinct we all do to sort of stay true to our vision. This is the thing that we feel the most competent to create. But then you don't want to just be blinded by that. And if somebody's giving you an actual really good advice, and all these people that I'm pitching, they're super smart people who know a lot about how business works, right? It's not like they're jerks and stupid, you know, they are smart people. So that's the conflict. It's not like, am I trying to stay true to something? It's sort of like, what is the right decision here? And how do you figure out how to make that decision?
Yeah. I do think also, what's interesting is the dynamic between you and your wife.
Yeah.
Because
people have been calling for her to have her own spinoff.
She's great. Yeah. Obviously, well, you know she's great. But well, she's also, there's this moment, and we played an excerpt of it at the, you know, in the billboard at the very top, this idea where, she, you know, you are kind of, as you say, kind of whining. I mean, you just had to spend money on this laptop, and you're kind of griping about all of that. You were supposed to take the kids to the zoo. You didn't get a chance to do it, and you haven't packed yet, and you've got to leave on this business trip the next day. And Nazanin is trying to be supportive, trying to say all the right things. But she says, look, it's hard to be, as she puts it, it's hard to have a generousness of spirit when you've got a four-year-old and a two-year-old. You have two kids. She's got a full-time job. Yeah. I guess this is, and this is the part one of the parts I really love about this podcast is because these are the real things you've got to take into account when you do something like this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, this was my hope for this was that I was finding all these things to be true, and I was finding this to be surprisingly, like the things that I thought were going to be hard were not even the things that were hard about it. And just the loneliness of the journey, the emotional loneliness of trying to do this thing, of starting over and trying to do something that you have no idea how to do and the rules are all very different than what you're used to. And I hadn't been prepared for that. But I felt like I can't be the only one experiencing these feelings, right? Yeah. There must be other people who are going through this process must be feeling the same way. But it was really scary to put some of those things out. Like, it was really, like... And it's also really weird because I am actually trying to raise money for this company.
Right.
And so to, and you know, obviously everybody that I'm pitching, they know the deal, like there's a microphone in their face. They understand that I'm recording this for this thing. And partly it's a selling point, like, oh, this is a creative, look at you, this creative founder doing this creative thing as he's pitching. Like, that's exciting. Mm-hmm. But also, like, I'm saying real things that are like, that are all about my own self-doubt,
yeah,
which is sort of the opposite of what you want to project to the people you're trying to raise money to. So it was like this, that was another big part of this is like how, you know, what are the consequences of this going to be,
yeah,
for, you know, for the people I'm trying to raise money from. It turns out like everybody sort of appreciates honesty if you present it well. So it's been, it actually hasn't had a negative effect. If anything, it's been sort of the opposite. People see the show out there and it sort of like clues them in, oh, like, oh, this is what he's talking about. And so now I can sort of see the kind of program he's talking about. So it makes sense to me now.
Episode four, the latest episode, it's the most personal yet. And I wanted to play a couple of clips from it. This first one is this conversation you have with a guy that a lot of people, the name they'll recognize, Andrew Mason, the former CEO of Groupon. And you've approached him for support. He's made hundreds of millions of dollars. He, in some ways, was looking for someone like you because he wants to create content with this new company he's got. But you, of course, are asking money from him, and you pitch it pretty well. I mean, he's interested. He's interested in it, and set up this section. I want to play this conversation because he asks you this really difficult question here at the end, but. I guess you're interested in why it is that a guy like that, if this is not a venture business necessarily, if it's not a new Twitter, why would Andrew Mason be interested? Is that what you're like, what are you interested in?
Well, what we came to, like, it might be the next Twitter. I don't want to, you know, write that off. Perhaps it will be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't think at the beginning of Twitter, they thought Twitter was going to be Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, I talked to Chris Sacca and he was like, he said as much. But what I was realizing is sort of like everybody invests for very idiosyncratic reasons,
right,
and they are all over the map. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was sort of have a conversation with him about why did he invest in this company? Like, what, you know, what was it about the opportunity that he found enticing? And, you know, he references his company in the tape, I think, that you're about to play. So I should just set up, like, the whole reason I know Andrew Mason is because he approached me because he's starting a company,
yeah,
that it relies heavily on audio content. So all of a sudden, he had demand for the set of skills that I possess. So that's how he came into contact. So I asked him that question, and the reply was really interesting.
The reason that I invested in you was... for a couple of reasons.
Okay.
It wasn't to make money.
All right.
One is like purely exploitative. Like, I just want you close to me for the purpose of my own business, right? Because I can learn things from you, and you can introduce me to people, and et cetera, et cetera. So right. This is like an investment in my own business. But the other reason was like you're good at what you do, and I'm a believer in investing in people.
What do you think is going to happen with your money that you gave me? What do you think the return is going to be? Are you expecting a return? How are you viewing that money now?
So this is the first time that I've thought about that. You asking it right now. I think
so. Clearly, you didn't make this thinking like, "Oh, this is going to make me a big return." Like, this was not that was not the primary reason for investing.
No, like, well, I think there's probably a higher likelihood than average that you will be able to generate a profitable business, and a lower likelihood than average that it's going to be, you know, 100, that has the potential to be 100xer. Mm-hmm. The only question I have about whether or not I feel like if you're not successful, it's going to be because you didn't want it enough. And there's a lot of good reasons that you might not want it enough.
Uh-huh.
Like, I have a kid now,
mm-hmm.
and I'm worse at running a startup because of that.
Right.
I mean, it's hard. It's hard. It's an insane amount of work. And balancing that with not just having a family, but like fulfilling your responsibilities to that family, if you choose to do that, is I don't understand how anyone could do that without making trade-offs. I think the people that tell you that, oh, it just forces you to be more thoughtful about how you manage your time, mm-hmm. are really that's a story that they're telling themselves.
Right.
I mean, what are they going to say? No, I'm worse at my job.
Mm-hmm.
I'm worse at my job. There's no question about it.
Like, that's the toughest question. Do you want it bad enough? Are you still working that out?
Yeah. I think, you know, I have said, you know, oh, it just forces you to manage your time better. So I'm guilty of that rationalization and that delusion myself. If it literally does come down to a choice between, you know, making a successful company and, you know, abandoning my family, I will go with my family. Like, that is not, there's not a question in my mind,
yeah.
Obviously. And I think most people who have families that they love would make the same decision. So it is a tough question. I'm hoping that it is actually somehow, like, I keep looking for like a secret, like there is a way to balance it. You know what I mean? Because that's the only option, right? If the trade-off really is family or success, then the business is doomed, right? Because I'm not going to abandon my family for the business. And I'm just assuming that the trade-off cannot be that stark.
Right. Let me ask you this finally. So you, I wonder if you figure your role is going to change. If you worry about that, I mean, you got promotion, you've got marketing, you've got hiring, you know, you're a producer. I mean, you write and you collect tape, and I'm wondering how you figure your role may change. And I know you're already producing pieces. What happens to startup? That goes away eventually, and then the rest of the shows take over. Is that the idea?
Actually, well, this was one of the sort of the things that has been proven out, that we, that our secret hope was that startup would become popular in its own right, and that we would be able to, that it would strike a chord, which it seems like it has, that there's a lot of people in sort of like in this kind of community who can really relate to sort of the stuff that we're talking about. So what we're hoping to do is to, I don't know, we have plans that we want to try to continue it, just not about our company,
right?
And we're going to try to make that work. So it would be, you know, maybe we would do another season where we would profile somebody else's company. So the trick would just be finding people who are willing to open up about every single embarrassing detail of the journey they're on. So if you know anybody, let us know.
I bet I do. Alex, thanks very much. Good luck, by the way.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Alex Bloomberg, his new undertaking, Startup, the podcast, you can find it at herestartup.com or just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org for the website. Alex joined us from the studios of NPR New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.